ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land, green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, and welcome back to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. My name is Connor Madison. I am EAA's staff photographer, and the Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems, the smarter way to manage, maintain, and safeguard your aircraft's value. And today, podcast host, across from me is...
Sam Olson, senior editor.
Awesome. And so today we're honored to have retired Navy Commander Herman Cook, who is a former F-14 pilot. And yeah, take it away. Glad to have you here.
Hey, Connor. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be up here today. And I, as you said, I'm a former F-14, F-18 pilot and flew for about 20 years in the Navy and then retired.
Fantastic. So let's start kind of back at the beginning. What got you interested in aviation in general?
Yeah, I would say that came from my dad, who always wanted to fly and couldn't, and dragged me to every air show that we could get to around the neighborhood. So, and told stories of his World War II buddies. He's a vet that all flew. And so that kind of just piqued an interest in me of, I like all things mechanical anyway. So what's better than something mechanical that flies, right?
Absolutely.
So take me through when you decided to go from your flight training to, you know, why you decided to join the Navy. What was that process?
Yeah, so I went to school in just a Texas Tech University, a public university in Texas. And about my senior year, you know, when you're about to graduate, it's like, holy smokes, I've really got to go out and get a job now. And one of my really good friends, who was a private pilot, was being recruited by the Air Force. Hey, they're hitting college kids up. And I said, well, I would really like to do something like that. So I actually went and talked to the Air Force, who at the time were like, we could use some navigators. You can always be a pilot later. And I'm like, well, that doesn't sound too good. And I talked to the Navy, and they're like, hey, we'll put you through the test. If you pass, we'll take you. And if you don't, you don't have to go. And I said, oh, that sounds pretty good to me. And so that just let it off right there.
Okay. I guess just kind of along that same vein, you join the Navy, you want to be a pilot. What was the process from initial flight training to up to the F-14? I mean, what was that? What was the stages of the training?
Yeah, so not being ROTC, I joined the Navy and I went to aviation officer candidate school. So I spent about 4 months getting beat up to become a Navy officer, and if that's something you don't finish, then, you know, you just leave, no harm, no foul. So, and the good thing is I only had about 8 days after school, so I couldn't rethink that decision, right? And then when I finished there, I joined flight training, and flight training was all about your grades. It took about 2 years. So at the first end of primary flight school, if you got the grades, you go to jets, and then you go to jet training. And if you got the grades, then you hopefully get the airplane that you want to fly out there. And I wanted to fly fighters at the end of all that and had the grades to get them. And so that's where I ended up. So kind of a, you know, that's just kind of a dream come true. Worked just like it was supposed to. So
awesome. Awesome.
That's awesome. What were the aircraft that you flew in training?
I flew a T-28 to start off with. I'll speak about that later, but I made a note. If you've ever been to the Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, which is another great museum, the one that's hanging from the ceiling there is the exact airplane that I soloed in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome.
And from the T-28, I went to the T-2, which was a twin-engine jet trainer, and then on to the TA-4, which we did more advanced combat and air-to-ground type training. And then you carry a qual, and you get your wings, and from there you select. That's about a two-year process.
Mm-hmm. So I know kind of a unique thing that I think still is true, that the U.S. Navy is the only Navy in the world that has their fighter pilots land on carriers at night. And I know that's a really harrowing experience for pretty much everyone that's gone through it. I don't know if you could tell us about your experience.
Yeah, that is what makes us unique. You know, I think the Chinese are experimenting a little bit, but nobody's doing it like we do. That's absolutely the hallmark of naval aviation, is being able to get out there and fly those night missions and come back. As far as what that's like, it's 2 hours of drilling holes around at night, followed by about 2 minutes of terror. It is not fun. You get good at it, but I couldn't say that landing at night on the ship is ever fun, like
sure,
the daytime. So it can be quite scary, but you just get proficient at it because you have to and learn to do it. So,
wow.
So, all right, you get your wings, you select the F-14. Is that how that worked?
So you put a wish list.
Okay.
So the Navy needs come first, and they'll always tell you that. So you get a dream sheet. I want to go here and fly this. I want to go here and fly this. And then they don't tell you ahead of time. So when you get your wings, it's a secret up till that point. And then they'll come out and say, here's your orders. And then in my case, there was just one set of fight orders that week of our class that graduated. And I had the highest grades, and I wanted to go there. So that's what I did. So.
Okay. So take us through the, you know, the time you're able to select the F-14 to, I know you go to Top Gun and, you know, that school. What led up to that, and how did you get selected or were able to attend, you know, the premier, you know, training school?
Yeah. So it takes about 9 months once you get in F-14s to finish the F-14 training program. That's the first time, by the way, that you land at night. So you finish that up, and then you'll get orders to a squadron, an operational squadron somewhere. And I did, to the VF-32, the same squadron. You have an airplane, one of their airplanes here in the museum. And at some point, your squadron is going to deploy. Mine deployed pretty quickly. I actually joined it between deployments and then did a little workups and deployed. Now, you're not going to get to go to Top Gun. The squadrons are going to get about one quota every year and a half or 2 years. And that's going to be when you're not on cruise. So after my first deployment, we came back to squadron, I had a quota, and I got selected for that. So you're going to have enough experience, you know, under your belt. You've already done a cruise. You've demonstrated that you're proficient and you're good at being a fighter pilot. And then it boils down to the CO just gets to pick. So he's going to pick the pilot in the Rio that he wants to send that day. And that's how I got selected for that. So
Okay.
And so I could play that up. Obviously, you got to be good, and you've got to be at the top of your game because it's competitive.
Sure.
There's a lot of guys in the squadron that want to go.
Sure.
And it worked out. I was fortunate. So that was me.
So
that's excellent.
I mean, just kind of, you know, continuing on the Top Gun topic, what was the training like? I mean, we've seen the movies, and maybe you can touch on that as well, the differences between the real life thing and what's depicted in the movies. But What was that training like? How intense was it?
It was, and I don't want to spoil all my thunder from the presentation tonight because I know you're going to tape that. But
sure.
It was by far the best and most intense training that you could go through. And I tell people, just imagine what you think it's like. It's better than that. It's a doctorate level course in being a fighter pilot. So it'll start pretty basic, and they're going to hone your skills as a basic fighter pilot. And it's going to work all the way up through, you know, the ability to lead large strikes with a large number of airplane against an unknown number of assailants out there. Now, that program continually evolves. And it's a little different today than it was back when I went through it. At the time I went through it, they would train you up, send you back your squadron, and you pass that on. Now it's even longer, and you get a little bit more of a specialty qualification and get orders somewhere to go. So, but that's what it was all about. It was about getting you trained to the highest level possible so that you could go back and share that knowledge in there. And it was busy, and it wasn't all flying. There were a lot of academics and a lot of classroom time involved in that too. So,
Okay.
What sort of, when you were in Top Gun, what were the adversary aircraft that you were flying against?
So Top Gun in-house was flying A-4s, F-5s, and F-16s when I went through.
Okay.
And in part of your 1v1 and some of your syllabus, they would bring guests in. So occasionally you might see a fighter weapons school F-15 from down in Nellis or an F-18 from up in China Lake. I like to talk about this because we can now, but it's not all in-house in San Diego. By the way, I went through in San Diego back in the good days, right? But we went down to Nellis Air Force Base, and I flew in Constant Peg, which you may know about. It was highly classified at the time, and only about 10 years ago, I believe, that we could talk about that. But the U.S. had acquired some MiG aircraft that they had stashed out in the desert, and we went down there and flew sorties against those guys. So we got to fly against real-life adversaries, if you will, as part of our training.
Were those MiG-23s?
They had MiG-23s and MiG-21s when I went through.
Okay.
I believe they also had 17s, but I didn't see one of those.
So. Gotcha. So Top Gun training, I mean, did you train while the original movie was coming out, or were you before or after? I'm just wondering, like, how much attention was on this fighter weapons school while this big movie is, you know, out in the public.
Yeah. So another one of my fortunate times in life, I went the year after the movie came out. So it was really cool for me. You know, everybody knew about Top Gun at that time. So not that as fighters, we didn't already know about it, but now the whole world knows about it, right? I think the movie came out in 86 and I went through in 87. So.
And as you watch the movie, I'm sure you were, you know, watching it and say, you know, oh, this wasn't exactly how something like this would go down, or, you know, that was inaccurately portrayed. What kind of, you know, it's certainly it's Hollywood, so you expect there's some, you know, some liberties to be taken. But what are some of the differences between the real thing and, you know, the movie?
Yeah, and I don't like to spoil it for people because I enjoyed the movie, right? And the flying scenes in the new one, too. But obviously, a lot of the dogfighting stuff is two airplanes really close together because they need to get them in the picture all the time. In reality, you're spread out. You're flying big circles in the sky and pointing at each other and dogfighting from a mile, you know, or a half a mile apart. So it was more like flying formation there for a while. And then some of it, like one of my really, really good friends was the F-5 MiG pilot that flew upside down above the Tomcat. And we wouldn't do that in real life. Although that sounds really cool, right?
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I guess let's get back to your, you know, when you go back to your squadron again, probably, I guess, what reason you're here, you know, the incident you had a real life encounter with enemy MiGs. I don't know if you want to talk about that incident.
Yeah, so I made a deal with the Navy when I went through Top Gun to extend my first tour in the Navy. So it was a longer tour, and I ended up, as fortune would have it, or as fate would have it, out on that second cruise, probably at a point when I would have been back, orders back to it. So it was right at the very end of my second cruise, and it was not the first time that we had gone down and done Freedom of Navigation Acts in the vicinity of Libya. You got to be a little bit older to remember the timeline, but back then the U.S.-Libya relations were pretty strained, right? They had killed some U.S. servicemen. We had traded some shots at boats, and the Libyan terrorists were acting up. We had run a bombing mission in there. So it was a little bit strained and a little bit tense. We didn't know exactly what to expect out of that. Although I will tell you that day, that was unexpected. I was fairly cavalier because cat missions in the Navy, they can be a little bit boring. Sometimes, you know, they're fly around in circles for a couple hours and nothing happens and then go back home. So that's what led up to that. And in this particular day and time, the Libyan fighters launched out of Albamba Airfield and came north and vectored on us. And I couldn't tell you why, but that chose that day to do it. So,
I mean, just kind of talk about the, you know, you guys see them, they're coming at you. What was the mindset from, I mean, you're obviously communicating with, you know, the carrier and everyone else. I mean, what was the process, you know, going from when you first detect them to deciding to engage and, you know, ultimately shoot them down?
Well, we had been briefed on the rules of engagement before we left the ship, right? And at the time, the U.S. was in ROEs are always highly classified because they don't tell the bad guys when we are or we are not going to shoot, right? So, but the U.S. government wasn't in a position where they were going to lose any U.S. assets at all to a Libyan aircraft. So that was number one. They don't get to shoot anybody down. So they had fighters down there that day. And when they vectored north on us, we vectored south on them. And we had good command and control. All of our initial vectors came out of the E-2, the early warning aircraft, which is out off the carrier. I remember running south on these guys, and it was quite a long intercept. It was started at about 75 miles. We picked them up at about 75 miles. Good F-14 radar there, long range. And we ran south, and I remember thinking to myself that day, you know, I didn't expect that to happen. I expected them to turn around or do whatever they had been doing, kind of head fake us. And they continued on. And I remember getting to 30 miles, you ask about mindset, thinking, wow, this is really going to happen. These guys are really going to run at us with armed floggers out of Libya. So that was really where, you know, we're going to put our game plan into motion so that if they try to enter a weapons law with us, we're not going to let them do that. And that's essentially the mindset we had going in there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah, okay, it does.
Super.
So that that whole incident was classified for a number of years, was it not?
Well, some of the details were. I mean, it was public that it happened.
Gotcha.
Because it made the news, right?
Sure.
And I think they released the audio of my flight lead's tape at the time and maybe a couple pictures because President Bush or Vice President Bush, I remember, made a comment that said, hey, I remember it because it kind of stuck out. They had a picture of the Libyan up there with missiles under his wing. And when people said, hey, these were bad guys, he goes, yes, that's not a bouquet of flowers there hanging under his wing, right?
Right.
So I think some of the details and the ROE and the debrief points, they remained classified for a long time. You're right.
Was there any, I know after the fact, you know, Libya and Gaddafi, you know, ordered a, you know, they wanted the United Nations to get involved. They said these were just reconnaissance planes, which, you know, clearly wasn't true. Was there any fallout, you know, on the Navy side of things for, you know, whether or not this should have happened like it did?
You know, not to my knowledge. We did a pretty thorough scrub and debrief on it. And of course, anything that would have been decided on whether we should have been down there messing with Libya would have been well above my level, because these exercises took Joint Chief of Staff approval. So they didn't put an aircraft carrier down there in front of Libya unless Washington said, go do it. It wasn't something we just routinely did on our own. These were planned and calculated, as, you know, Libya liked to claim territorial waters that were way out there, way in excess of the international recognized limits of 12. And we said, no, you don't get to do that. So the U.S. government would steam through there. As far as our fighter pilot debrief, we actually did fly out to Top Gun and do a pretty thorough debrief. And that's typical for Navy fighter aviation, right? We debrief everything. We work really hard because there's no such thing as a perfect flight, right? So we'll debrief the flights. What could we do better? We'll take the goods and others and criticism and move on with the day. So no fallout for me at all. I can't tell you politically. I don't know of any, though.
Okay.
So
was there... It's just kind of interesting, you know, that you got to fly against, did you say MiG-23s when you were in Top Gun?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I imagine probably like your training went further beyond what actually happened in that incident.
You know, oh, absolutely.
It's like you guys definitely had the upper hand pretty much the entire time.
In Top Gun, we actually got into a dogfight with these guys. And by the way, the two MiGs that I fought there were flown by Navy pilots.
No kidding.
That were on orders to the Air Force squadron. You know, secret orders out in the desert. Their logbooks didn't say they flew this. They said they flew A-7s or F-5s or something like that. So we trained pretty hard with those guys. I would say overall, much harder and all across naval aviation than you'll ever see in real life, right?
Sure. Yeah, kind of that mentality of like preparing for more than you should ever expect. I mean, it's
absolutely
probably the best kind of preparedness there is.
Yeah, and that's a knock on wood for the training, right? You know, so when you get out there and it gets stressful, hopefully you fall back on what you know how to do and do it correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look at the alternative. If they'd have shot us, I wouldn't be here filming this podcast.
So. Right.
That's true. That's true.
We'd like to thank our sponsor for the Green Dot. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crewchief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crewchief's intuitive platform unifies all your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crewchief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, save 15% for the lifetime of your Crewchief GA subscription when you use coupon code GREEN15. That's GREEN15 at crewchiefsystems.com. All right, now let's get back to this awesome conversation.
So that happens in 1989. What was the progression of your career, you know, after that?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I got orders back to an adversary squadron after that, and the Navy flying the F-16 and the A-4, and I got to instruct, right? So that was an absolutely wonderful tour. If you can imagine just going up on nice days and dogfighting all day, 5 days a week, it just doesn't get any better than that. And we're training fleet F-14 and F-18 pilots in air-to-air combat skills. I did that for a tour, and then I got married, and life changes, right? And I left the Navy. I left active duty. But I did so when I could affiliate with a flying reserve unit. So I went back to F-14s at that point and flew F-14s with the Texas Navy, if you will. There was two squadrons in Dallas, Texas. And if you want me to fast forward there, so I did that for a number of years, 5 or 6 more years. In fact, got to drop bombs as the air-to-ground mission came into the F-14 community. And at some point, the Navy retired the A's, and I transitioned to F-18s. And so I finished out my flying career there flying the Hornet.
Okay.
I'd love to hear about the, you know, switching to that bombing role with the F-14. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I guess the technology was always in the airplane. We always had the air-to-ground role. And first, we just picked up, you know, iron bombs, dumb bombs, which the airplane did very well. And then at some point, we transitioned to laser-guided munitions. We had laser spark trackers and laser pods that we could carry on the airplane so we could do laser-guided munitions. And then I retired before they got to it, but eventually the F-14, you know, transitioned to a lantern pod and was employed in the Gulf War over there using even more modern technology, so smart weapons, if you will. I enjoyed doing it. It was a very stable platform, very accurate, and delivered air-to-ground weapons just wonderfully. And the gun works air-to-ground just fine, too. So, mm-hmm.
Was this all with the A model?
This was all with the A model.
Okay. Uh-huh. The F-18, you know, and Connor and I were discussing this earlier, but, you know, we had another F-14 pilot in here a number of years ago, and she was one of the last ones to fly it before, you know, before it was retired. She loved the F-14. She also flies the F-18. You know, she noted that the F-18 is kind of, you know, the if you're comparing it to an automobile, it's, you know, it's fuel efficient and it doesn't have many, you know, mechanical issues, where, you know, the F-14 is this big muscle car and it's expensive and it you know, it might take a little bit more, you know, care and love to keep it running, but she loved the F-14 and would choose. What's your opinion, you know?
Yeah, I think I would find that similar. You know, I love flying the airplane, but I got to tell you, the Hornet's a sweet jet. And I like that comparison. I use this. The F-14 is the Harley Davidson of the fighter community. Well, then the Hornet is a Ducati. Okay. It is a sports car. It is just a good time machine. It's really maneuverable. It's really a good cockpit for the single fighter pilot, stable platform. Obviously, it's not as big and fast as a Tomcat was, but it does a lot of things really, really well. So, and I like having two motors. So I enjoyed them both. I obviously have way more time in the F-14 than the F-18, but I can't say anything bad about it. So
how many hours do you have in the F-14?
I think I have north of 2,000, okay. And I'm not sure. So 2,100, 2,200, somewhere right in that range.
Okay. Were you disappointed? Were you disappointed when the Navy decided to retire it?
You know, I'm one of those guys that thinks that as new and greater technology comes along, it's usually worth it.
Okay.
So, you know, it's sad to see it go, but I mean, having flown the F-14 and having flown the F-16 and having flown the F-18, and I'd have given anything to flown the F-35. So I'm okay with getting newer and better and higher tech and more capable aircrafts right there. So yeah, I hate that pretty much every airplane I ever flew is now on a sticker in a museum. So they do go away.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Did you fly, what models of the Hornet did you fly?
A models only.
Okay. So like what we'd call the legacy Hornet?
Correct.
Nice, gotcha. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's neat. So it's, I mean, not every day we get to talk to an F-14 pilot. Have you seen the Top Gun Maverick, the movie?
Yeah.
So there's a maneuver at the end where he splits the throttles in the dogfight. I mean, is that something you ever did? Is it even possible?
So, well, it's possible. And an F-14A with a TF-30, if you mess with the throttles while you're fighting, you're going to stall an engine.
Oh, okay.
So that is not something we did every day, I would say. Is it possible? Yeah, it's possible.
Probably,
but it probably wouldn't have a good ending to it.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's neat. I don't know if there's any... 2,000 hours, I'm sure just about every flight in the F-14 was memorable. I mean, are there other ones that stick out that you could talk to us about?
You know, there's times, you're exactly right, that stick in your brain. You know, you kind of, that jet fit like a glove for me. So I'm not normal ops don't stick out at all. But, you know, I can remember a scary night, one night at the ship. I can remember one time dogfighting my buddy. Now, you take two F-14s and two pilots, and everything's just alike, and that's a grind, right?
Yeah.
That is a fight where usually nobody gets the upper hand, and you just fight down to a draw. But I can remember one time, and it was toward the end of that career. I'm fighting a guy, and when you're dogfighting, spatially, you don't care about anything but his airplane and the ground, right? You can be upside down, sideways, whatever. You're trying to pull him to your lift vector and get a shot. And I remember coming over the top one time, and if you fly airplanes, you know this, and I'm looking back at him, and I'm watching, and all of a sudden I notice, you know, nothing's happening when I put in controls, which usually means as I look down that I don't have any airspeed, okay? I've gone over the top when I didn't have enough knots to complete that loop. And I remember that jet's tail started tail sliding down, and then it flipped around nose down, and those TF-30s that I talked about, they do not like running when they don't have air going down them. So both engines stall.
Oh.
So I'm pointing downhill and I'm thinking, okay, I've got a lot of time in the airplane and get some air coming down by the pipes again and take the throttles off, shut them down, start them, bring it back around, start it right back up. And everything's fine. I flew off. And the reason I remember that, because I give my buddy a hard time all the time, is in pure, you know, in true fighter pilot fashion, he rolled around behind me and called a shot and called me dead. And I always questioned him. I said, I'm not sure how you got a tone on that heat seeker when my motors weren't running. So there are times like that. Yeah, I can remember that, you know, they're a lot funnier now than they were when they happened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever have to do like a lot of single engine flying in that? Or what was that like in the A model?
You know, I, knock on wood, didn't have a whole lot of problems with that. I would say I could probably count on a couple of fingers the times I had came back single engine. Oh, okay. It was usually because an engine stall or ramp dropped or something. And fortunately, I never did it at the ship.
Yeah.
So that all happened to me at the beach. And it flew okay. I mean, where you would get in trouble in the airplane is if you were dogfighting a lost one, because then the adverse yaw, you know, from the engine could throw you into an out-of-control position that you don't want to be in. But otherwise, it was pretty honest. It didn't have a lot of power. So, but, you know, you fly it. That's what you train to do. So.
I guess, so let's roll back to your adversary flying. Curious to know, you know, your thoughts on flying the F-16.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun flying that airplane. Now, the Navy flew them like nobody else, right? Slick, no hard points, no stores, no tanks, no nothing. So they were just incredible little dogfighting machines. I don't think there's an airplane made ever that could beat that with the thrust to weight that we had. And we were able to simulate just about anything we wanted to simulate. In fact, most of the time we dialed those back in order to say, hey, we're going to simulate a MiG-21 or a FLOG or whatever. And the only time we'd fly them full up was we were simulating a MiG-29 out there, maybe a lightweight MiG-29 that we would run into. So I went through Air Force training, which was only two flights. The okay. Navy only paid for two flights.
Okay.
And then I came back home and they said, there's your single seat fighter, go get in it and train yourself. And when you get enough time, we'll get you air-to-air qualified. So it was an enjoyable program and a great airplane. So,
What model F-16
they
was
were in models.
It was, cool.
The Navy purchased them special. They were C model F-16s essentially, with a big engine and small mouth and no gun, and you know they and an APG-66, the smaller radar. So they were specially built and purchased by the Navy just for that role. So they were not an operational type airplane.
So. I mean, pretty much like the ultimate, like a hot rod F-16.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, they had beacon augmenters on them at the time, just because they were such a small radar signature. We had to actually, you know, beef them up a little bit so they would show up out there. So
that's neat. Yeah. And then what else did you fly in the adversary role?
The A4. Okay. I actually went back to A4 school. We had single seat A4s, E's and F's. So those were old jets. We had a couple of X Blue Angel A4s as a Falcon squadron. So they were lightweight little hot rods. In fact, the F model A4 would do a triple Immelmann. A non afterburning airplane had enough power to do, you know, three.
Wow.
Vertical maneuvers in a row like that. So they were certainly not fast and not high too, but they were a great little visual in-close dogfighter. And we had F-5s at the same time. I actually went to school on that, but never ended up flying it because of scheduling. My F-16 school came up first, and that's where I went off to. So, but you would fly different airplanes in one day. We had different pegs with different flight gear, and wherever they schedule you, you went.
So. Mm-hmm. Was there, I mean, did you have a, you know, notebook of stuff? I just imagine kind of keeping mentally, keeping that straight, like what airplane you're in and what the procedures are. Or do you just kind of develop the mindset of, okay, this is what I'm in?
Well, yeah, you train really well. And then weekly we took little emergency procedures tests and stuff that kind of would, you know, refresh your brain on, hey, today I'm doing the F-16 emergency procedures, or today I'm doing the A-4. And we would brief those in the brief. So if you were an A-4 pilot, you'd brief out of control procedure for the A-4. If you're an F-16 that day, you'd brief it for the F-16. So we just kind of continually went over it. I will tell you that we had three varieties of A-4s, and they all had different engines, the E's, F's, and T's. So we cheated a little bit because there's no red marks on those engine instruments. That's old technology, right? So we had little placards in the cockpit there with like engine EGT limits and RPM limits on them and stuff to keep, we could refresh ourselves.
But yeah. Oh, that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
There's a civilian A-4 for sale right now on the Warbird market. And a friend of mine that's a civilian test pilot, we were trying to figure out, you know, like, man, what can we do to buy that? Because I can't remember the exact price, but it's like, I want to say $400,000. It's like ridiculously low.
Oh, wow.
When I imagine how fun that would be to fly, like your fun per dollar flight.
Yeah, the airplane, you know, the A-4 had a roll rate of 720 degrees per second. So that airplane was, it was really maneuverable. In fact, no autopilot, and you couldn't let go of it. If you let go of it to look down at a chart, you were usually upside down by the time you got to your knee board, because it would just roll off on you.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Kind of going back to, you know, some of your days on the aircraft carrier, just give us a little bit of a perspective of what life is like on a carrier out at sea. You know, you can't see land. You're out there for however long. What's it like?
Yeah, well, thank God I'm a pilot, because being out there 6 months on the ship and not going flying, I'm not sure how to handle that. But, you know, your day starts with a cat shot, right? That's your day in the office. Man up, go out, get shot off the front end. If it's a good weather day, it's just a whole lot of fun, you know. And the F-14, it was a kick to get off the ship. It was one of the heavier airplanes. And then depending on where you were, you'd get airborne, and you might have a really cool mission. You might be in a NATO exercise. You might be flying low levels across the Egyptian desert. You might be training, or it might be real life, and you're armed up with missiles, and you're just going to go 250 miles out and drive around in circles and on a combat air patrol mission to make sure nobody comes close to the ship. And then, you know, like all Navy pilots, your day's going to end with a trap. So you got to come back to the ship. If it's a really nice day, it's a lot of fun. You know, you come roaring into the carrier as fast as you can come and not get in trouble, and turn downwind and land. And it's a challenge, and it's just a lot of fun. And then about a third of my flights are at night, and they're nowhere near as much fun, but you would man up the night missions and go and do the same sort of mission at night. But usually that was an air-to-air role for us. So it was just being on cap or doing some sort of intercept exercise out there.
Okay. I'm not sure how many of these you got, but if you had a day off, what do you do on the carrier?
So if it's a mandated day off, they'll usually do training.
Okay.
So we might have half a day. In fact, we routinely did stand downs like that to do training. So you may end up with a whole day of academics or lectures or some kind of training in the ready room as a pilot group. So if it was an absolutely nothing going on day, then you probably tried to sleep about half of it.
Okay.
You know, cruise is only half as long if you sleep 12 hours
a day.
That's
true.
So, and then of course we went into port in the Navy. So, and that was always a lot of fun. So
okay.
You would hit the port, you'd have a, you know, 2 out of 3 days off and go tour, visit wherever you were, so.
Were you primarily in the Mediterranean, or where else were you?
Yeah, so I'm an East Coast sailor out of Virginia Beach. So we did the Atlantic, South, North Atlantic, and then most of our deployments were over in the Mediterranean. So that's where they kept an East Coast boat all the time. There was always somebody there. So
okay.
We would trade out carriers. So you were going to end up in the Med if you were an East Coast sailor.
Okay.
Gotcha. When you were flying the F-14, do you guys have to do aerial refueling?
We did.
Yeah. What types did you do do that with?
Yeah. So our organic assets on the carrier at the time I was there was usually A6s, right? Mm. So they had some KA6s, which were dedicated. And then they had buddy stores, much like the Hornet has, that they could strap on the wing of a regular A6 and you could get gas from them. And we tanked just about every mission in the Navy. So you would take off, go overhead, find the tanker, top off your aircraft, and then head on out. And the Navy's a drogue system, right? So it's you have the probe. You get up, and we do it a little differently from the Air Force. You know, it's all calm out visually, and you pull up on him and tell him, and he's going to tell you, hey, the drug's going out, and you get back there and plug the thing. From time to time, we would tank on Air Force KC-10s and KC-135s also, because if it was in Europe or somewhere where they had those assets around for big exercises or whatever we were doing, they would bring those out, and we would tank on them too. So a little bit harder to do, but, you know, I enjoyed tanking. It was another challenge. So it was, if you could fly a really good formation, then you could tank.
So, very good.
Awesome.
That's cool. And there, I imagine with the A6, I guess there wasn't, you know, the speed difference was manageable in that case.
Yeah. Yeah. So you didn't tank too fast, because if you got too fast, the drugs, you know, they pulled up into the jet wash of the airplane before. So right. You wanted it to hang down so that you weren't riding in the jet wash. You know, the Air Force would often want to tank up high, and we're like, no, come on down in the 20s and slow down a little bit and let us get in the drogue. It was, you know, you wanted that guy to be smooth, right? One of the funniest things I've ever heard, one time I was waiting on the tanker and the guy was having a really hard time getting in, and his backseater calls up to the tanker and he says, and I don't remember the call sign, you know, he says, hey, 400. He goes, if you're not on autopilot, get on it. And he goes, and if you are, get off of it. But he wasn't being smooth, and it was making it really hard for the guy behind him to get in the basket. Gotcha.
That's so funny.
As we kind of finish up here, I'm just curious, you know, you've flown a bunch of different types, you know, F-14, F-16, you know, A-4, F-18. What other types would you have liked to have flown, whether they're modern day stuff? You had mentioned the F-35 or stuff that was, you know, retired or not really flying by the time you entered the service.
Oh, I would hands down go for the modern stuff, man. If you could give me a helmet mounted sight and put me on an F-35, boy, I think that would just be the neatest thing out there, the capabilities. The Phantoms were around when I flew. I didn't have a big desire to fly those. I mean, I know the Phantom guys love them, but, you would have to go way back for me. I'd love to fly a P-51 or a Corsair or something like that. But otherwise, I think I hit the sweet spot in the Navy. I mean, it doesn't get much better than flying F-14s and F-18s.
Sure, so. Sure. I mean, have you had the chance since you're an airline pilot now? Have you had the chance to, you know, fly GA airplanes or any type of warbirds?
I have not.
Okay.
No, I've done very little GA flying, and quite honestly, I just haven't had the time. You know, for a lot of years there, I was flying, you talked about flying different kind of airplanes, so I'd be flying a couple of trans airplanes in the Navy and be flying an airliner, and at times two of those as I transitioned there wow. too. So I stayed really busy, and then life came on, and I have some desire to do that after I retire, but I've done little to none right now.
Okay.
Understandable, yeah. I think my last question, tell us what your call sign is and if you'd like how you got it.
Yeah, and it's not too hard to figure out for me, Connor. So
yeah.
My call sign's Munster, and my name is Herman. So there you go. The Munster's the TV show, Herman Munster. So that's, I remember walking into my ready room that day, and I'm a brand new guy, and they introduced me, and you know, hey, this is Herman Cook, and there's a guy yells it back. In fact, he's somebody you may know. He's Ward Carroll, one of my buddies in the squadron who does podcasts, and he yells, Munster! You know, so it was like just stuck. And if you try not to get that call sign, that guarantees you yeah. that you're going to get it. But it much preferable, I think, in my case, to earning one from doing something fairly infamous in an airplane, right? You know, I don't want to be called Crunch or Braha or any of those those kind of call signs.
100%. So. Was there one of those that you could tell us about, like from your time in the Navy?
No, well, it wasn't me.
Well, right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had, I remember my sister squadron had a guy run off the runway, and they called him Baja after that. And 2 weeks later, another one did it. And they're like, well, that was taken. They called him Travels. So you could get call signs from, and a few of them back in my time frame, which were, you know, not safe for work.
Sure.
They're not politically correct anymore.
Right.
But
yeah.
But at the time, we would, you could earn them several different ways.
Yeah.
You could earn one from being too famous on Liberty too. So
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all I had for you. So.
Yeah. I think. Same over here. So yeah, thanks again for joining us. We appreciate it. We're looking forward for your presentation tonight. I'm sure everyone listening, it'll be available online afterwards. It's going to come out a little later.
Yeah, I tried not to spoil it all. So
yeah, it was very good.
We'll talk a little bit more about. I'll talk a little bit more at that time about that intercept in Libya at the date and flying off the ship out there. So hopefully you found it interesting.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Yeah, we're looking forward to it. So I want to thank Scott for sitting behind the board and trying to make, you know, Sam and I sound like we know what we're talking about here. And then, of course, I want to thank everyone out there who listens to The Green Dot. We welcome any feedback that you might have, and you can send that to feedback@eaa.org. And, of course, any reviews you want to leave on whatever your podcast platform of choice is, prior episodes of The Green Dot, of course, are available there or on our blog at inspire.eaa.org. And we look forward to seeing you next time when you're cleared to land on the Green Dot.